Okay, so we should be on.
Hold on.
Okay, fine.
So, just to identify the voices.
Oh, okay, so
yesterday we did that.
Okay, this is Ben.
Ben, you asked your last
name? Sorry, Ben Gilmartin, Ben.
This is Ben Aranda, Ben.
Chris. At least you see on that day.
Are you going to introduce like the set of players, why we're here, or dive into it?
Yeah, it's all part of it. I'll be edited.
Because so. You'll just be edited out?
Yeah, I'll be edited out. Take it away.
Okay, so, this is Ben Aranda. Here with Chris Lash. Zero has come down to our studio here at Aranda Lash, and we're going to talk about his practice and ask him some questions.
It's not really a radio show.
I know, I feel like I'm talking to you. I know,
can we set the mood?
If you don't mind, like, I just kind of want to ask a question that's just to warm things up, and it's not specifically about your work, but we were wondering, because when we look at your work, we actually we have a lot of affinities to your approach. There are clearly certain rules that you establish in order to begin designing, and there's also it looks like a kind of tendency to do a lot of investigative research behind the work. So before we get into the kind of specific projects, I just want to ask you: are there any issues or questions right now that you're asking yourself?
Yeah, many. About the rules system, so in general.
In general.
I mean, actually, maybe it's a good point to start from, because in a way, it's related to the last point we were having in the previous conversation with David, with the living. Lately the points have been related to the problems that I feel I'm facing as a practice, and perhaps as part of a generation, or at least feeling that in the last 10 years there are certain things that are happening increasingly and that I find problematic, which I haven't written. and they have to do mostly with the fact that if I don't remember wrong, what we are doing has to do with empowering the discipline, and at least that's how it started in the 80s, the late 80s, with that will of finding a space where the discipline can have power and define its own terms as a practice, rather than being either disregarded as a field of knowledge, or rather than understanding itself as a completely autonomous field. In a way, all the work that has been happening partially before me or through my own work in the 90s and in the early 2000s has to do with developing systems or techniques or methods that would have as a aim the increase of capabilities for the practice. And one of the things I'm feeling is that that field of new techniques or new ways of operating has become, from being a means to empowerment, has become an end in itself. And I think that's something that I find problematic in my own practice or in my own teaching and in many other practices that are that I consider to be part of this last 15 years, in the sense that they don't really empower themselves, but rather they become services to other forms of power that are not necessarily disciplinary. So that's one of the, for example, the things I'm thinking about and how to avoid that kind of problematic.
How do you avoid that?
One of the ways is to not misunderstand the idea of specificity in the work, like with the idea of specialization. So by not letting any of the mechanisms of work become a completely formal model, like a completely formalized model, but rather staying as an open means to something else. So in a way, it's a question of carrying on developing the specificity of the procedures and complexifying them, and at the same time not letting that be understood as a closed methodology or as a field of expertise that has its own limitations. And also more politically or more tactically, I try to avoid any clear affiliation with any particular thematics. So that's why, in a way, my practice and my academic practice as well sort of jump from field to field.
What do you mean by thematics?
For example, there is a possible reading of the work I am doing, which is to reduce it to parametric design or sort of a very closed methodology of control of variables to produce objects, and then I try not to let that production capture the capabilities of the work, basically. So it doesn't become a service or a sort of technical service at disposal to I don't know, corporate offices or more conventional forms of practice. There is another reading of the work which is orientated to reading it as a sort of a structurally rational form of work. And I try that not to be a reduction of the work or the systemic reading of the work that tends to look at it as a form of landscape urbanism, which is partly something that I've been doing for many years. It's also a reduction of the work. And again, it's an easy way out in the sense that it could become a field of expertise in itself, but I think the specificity of that work doesn't have to do with the fact that one is creating professionals for that discipline in particular. That would be again the kind of instruments for urban planning, for example.
Chris? Do you want me to?
I appreciate this kind of resistance to kind of become represented by the techniques that you use. You know, you don't want to describe your work as a kind of parametric, as output. It's like a parametric practice or parametric project, so using parametric tools. The the fact is that the design systems you're using are parametric. I'm interested in maybe more, a better, or if you could go more in depth about how you kind of get around, what do the projects give you? What is working this way give you? That what does it open up for your practice?
Working what way? Working through parameters, or
yeah.
Well, mostly that, among other things, is part of a search for systems that mediate my decisions, basically. So, and in a way, it's quite a simple archaic operation. I mean, all I want is to construct sort of mechanisms like trying to control a marionette, right? Mechanisms that establish sort of distanciation between my capabilities as a designer and the actual grace or intelligence of the object I'm creating. And I do that through systems of control that let me kind of produce that mediation or that distanciation. And the parametric, in a way, is only part of that. It's a way of more specifically control the variables that are part of that system of mediation. So what to me is the value of that of creating that apparatus is present, if it is, in the sort of possibility of what I'm producing to produce something that has a behavior or a logic of its own that I would have never thought of or be capable of producing myself hands on.
Yeah.
So and that has to do with with different levels of the sort of characteristics of what I produce. On the one hand, with the sort of beauty or grace of the object that is produced. On the other hand, with the capability of absorbing complexity of that object. On the other hand, with the possibility of that object to establish communications with other people or with other fields or constraints. On the other hand, sometimes with the possibility of that object of having a certain status that, again, thematically is irreducible to a particular tradition or typology in architecture. So, in a way, we're inventing new forms of architectural artifacts that are not only new in terms of their form, but also new in terms of the way of practicing they involve. Sometimes that you cannot really define what they are. No, if they are pieces of furniture or structural models that are scaleless for different possible scales of architectural organization, or patterns that can be used for a wallpaper and for a large scale project. So it has to do also with that sort of openness and sort of strangeness about the type of work, the type of material that this is producing.
I get the sense. Yeah. I appreciate that about your work, the rigor and the work that goes into building up these complex systems are in a way developing system of control, but not necessarily like you said, like they would use it in a corporate office to control efficiencies or to control known quantities, but rather to suggest new possibilities, to kind of defy simple categorical distinctions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's something that we kind of look for in all our projects.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But let's dive into this. Like, there's there's implicit in what you're saying a kind of critique of new forms of power. And the words that you brought up are things like corporate offices. And it's as if, like, one very simplified narrative of kind of what you said is that we have access to tools and we kind of develop them from in an interest of maybe freeing up architecture from some of the mud that it was stuck in especially, I would say, in the 90s, and some of the discourses that it was maybe stuck in. And so we unhinge it, but you're saying that it's disappointing that, or there are problematics that emerge when these kind of techniques get into the wrong hands. And my question to you is, why is there this sense that there's a way to misuse this stuff?
That is what? What did you say?
Why? Is there an orthodoxy to this way of working? Is there both a kind of approach that is somehow opening up for the right reasons, and is there a kind of bastardization of these? Of these systems that you're developing.
Yeah. I wouldn't put it that way. I wouldn't put it in a fundamentalistic way. I would say there is the capability of this kind of work to produce a certain form of enigma and slipperiness and irreducibility to establish categories or to given forms and so on. And there is the tendency to, there is the sort of appetite from the market to reduce those capabilities to new forms of commodity, one way or another. And then they become, what is enigmatic becomes cliché, or becomes just obscure versus cliché. What is potentially powerful as a way of opening up different forms of engagements with problems becomes merely power in the sense of capability to deliver very quickly, very efficiently certain solutions for what is demanded at any scale. So I wouldn't say it's a question of orthodoxy versus bastardization, but the question of perhaps of irreducibility in relation to consumption.
Then let me ask you this: the point of using these techniques or engaging yourself in this kind of a milieu is to, in a way, lose control, or is to extend your ability to let's say make decisions, or you said to mediate decisions, right? I think what's so fascinating about a lot of these let's say procedural systems that are role based is that while they do kind of they do complicate the issue of decision making. What they're really good at is what I would describe as proliferating in the world. In other words, they have this kind of inherent tendency to become consumed and sort of accelerate, you know, their own trajectories. And so it's as if it's this kind of constantly cascading sand pile that builds up and then falls apart, builds up, falls under its own weight, and it's a movement. So how are, I mean, my question to you is, how do you engage this sort of propensity for things to always want to become, say, more complex or more parametric or more rule driven? I mean, it seems like what we need to what one would look for is a kind of way to have a voice within these systems, right? Your own approach that is maybe specific or kind of expertise, or
there's definitely a place for both of these approaches. I think there is something to be said for the kind of rationalization of the tool to like increase efficiencies, to be able to do things that you couldn't do before within a kind of prescribed in within a set of certain prescribed limits. There's a place for that. I think there is also this place for this kind of derationalization of the tool to like to misuse the tool and to make discoveries. And I think it's in that kind of area that we're all kind of looking to establish a kind of relationship with, and to establish a voice.
I don't know how much I'm kind of responding to, but maybe just adding a comment. I would say that there is a tendency, and anyway, it goes back to what we were discussing at the beginning. There is a tendency for complexity to become to become homogeneous again. So to just produce more of the same, more and more of the same, and then to neutralize itself, to neutralize its own novelty. What I'm trying to do in the last few years is to sort of work against the grain in that, and basically work counterintuitively with complexity. So, for example, one of the issues that you can observe in the colors of that is that I am trying to sort of recognize the moment when the complexity touches, or the version of complexity can become a means to produce new forms of classicism. And so basically stable artifacts that to a certain extent have the challenge of in a way producing something, producing conditions that are so unique and particular and different from the contexts or options that they can be recognized as a sort of fixed permanent conditions to a certain extent. And in a way that's one of the ways in which I engage with this question of the indifferentiation that the excessive production of complexity is producing lately. It's increasing the capabilities, producing basically constantly indifferent things.
Would an attribute of this new type of classicism be symmetry?
I would say that it's not perhaps, but not as a point of arrival, but as a default. As a default that doesn't need to be challenged unless it really needs to be challenged. Symmetry or repetition or any other sort of fixity in the way to manage complexity, I would look at that as a sort of primitive that doesn't need to be abandoned, except if it needs to be abandoned.
Right. How do you accommodate for program within something that that remains sort of fixed?
By complexifying it, by abstracting it.
It being the program?
No, the organization.
The thing, yeah.
The thing. And by abstracting the program as well. I'm just telling you literally what I do. I mean, when I, like, for example, in the house, I'm doing, that's one of the ways in which I deal with that. When I have to engage with any need of differentiation due to whatever, relations to the orientation or relations to the circulation or relations to the side conditions of any kind, that will introduce any particularity in the system, or even internal conditions like variations in the balance of the programs and so on. The way I respond to that is by complexifying the system so that it can handle the range of difference while keeping its symmetry.
Okay. Clear. So, in other words, producing more orders rather than any disorder.
Yeah, producing a kind of richer order or a more multi
embedded orders,
multiple order.
Can you talk about disorder or, let's say, things that don't have the kind of information that order has? Is that interesting to you?
It's interesting to me as a means to complexify the order.
To learn about order.
To challenge the form of order that any need of disorder makes evident. That any need of disorder makes evident that the order at stake is not sufficient. So I use disorder as a way of complexity of recognizing an incomplete condition in the system of order. And immediately after, I complexify the system of order.
So disorder is a way to find other kind of orders that you might not recognize yet as,
yes,
as an order.
Yeah. And it's always the temptation, because of expressive terms and because of one's always present will of perhaps coming from modernism of letting all the disorder happen one way or another. That's always the temptation.
Why is that? Because information wants to be free in a way.
Why is that a temptation, or why is that?
Why is that propensity towards disorder perceived as more expressive? This legacy that we have from modernism.
Right? Yeah. Do you look for
things to destabilize the system?
I don't look for them; they come to me. They are impossible to avoid. I mean, the moment you open your eyes, they are there.
We can ignore the how do you respond to the question of where I just sort of, we're not the ones on trial here.
It's supposed to be a 2A.
Well, I think we couldn't agree more. we talk about randomness for a second. It's a great tool to decrystallize a system, but you want to. It's a great solvent. Let's say disorder, noise, randomness. It's a great way to dissolve something in order to find other avenues. But you're always looking for further forms of crystallization, other means of building order.
Now, the dissolution is in itself is fun, but it's the new equilibrium that you find that becomes really satisfying.
Yeah,
that's where you make discoveries.
I mean, I tend to think that in that sense, architecture is solid as a rock.
Yes.
in the end, it's inert material.
Yes.
No matter all the
sure.
very interesting kind of vital moments in the process.
But let's talk about this rock. If you pick up any rock, a rock has keys to its universality in it. Mm-hmm. Right? You can recognize. Certain forms of crystal structure, but every rock is unique from any other rock and has a kind of specificity to it that comes from wind, water, its geological sort of formation. So there's all these types of specificity to this universal substrate, right, to this crystal. So But you talk about these sort of these new forms of classicism, and we can see in your work a propensity for a high degree of order in many axes. Mm-hmm. Is there room for specificity in the way that that maybe a rock might be specific to its origins?
Well, the way I see the projects, or maybe it's my wishful thinking. Is that they are all made of specificity. So they are sort of forms of organizing progressively higher levels of complexity of specificity. Only that I just don't let the specific become accidental. Mm-hmm. But rather I utilize it again. That's all. So, I mean, of course, different projects I did have a different degree of specificity and a different degree of complexity. But in a way, I see the projects, all of them, from the most kind of single level ones to the most complex ones, the most kind of layered projects. I always see them as sort of a state of things towards the absorption of specificity. So they are at the same time incomplete in the sense that they can always absorb further levels of specificity, but they are always, whatever they do absorb, they always turn them into part of their system. But I don't know if I answer you. Maybe you have to say more about the rock. Okay. If you want me to answer that question more.
Well,
rocks aren't symmetrical.
Yeah.
They're not, but they're always rock, right? Through and through.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm interested in kind of how, I mean, basically, if I can, I'm glad I'm gonna have a chance to edit this later because I gotta work it right.
We're gonna edit it.
She's going to show us.
Well, good. Write this fucking down.
Yeah. Get this one.
So we share this tendency to look at order as. As a foundation to any effort to build something, and I would say we also look at any instantiation of architecture as a rehearsal for how matter in the universe assembles itself. And we learn order through matter. I think that's something. When I see your work, I would imagine you're also interested in matter, and because it teaches you about order implicitly. So, these new forms of classicism are so. I would like to hear you talk more about it, because as matter unfolds, it produces differentiation, right? As the rock becomes more of the rock that it becomes, it becomes more specific. Yet in these new forms of classicism, what we find is that while there is the specificity that you talk about, it's actually more and more order. So it's almost, I think this issue of entropy needs to come up. I mean, the new forms of classicism that you're talking about seem to resist entropy in a way, or at least resist the kind of frayed edges and produce a kind of, a new embedded order, but not in the way that the rock is this asymmetric, specific condition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think there are two questions. If I can remember them now. One is the resistance to entropy, and the other is the mode in which the work does that, different to a rock, in the sense that it's symmetrical.
Let's just say that I asked those two, and you just said that was me talking. So now you answer.
Yeah. No, of course. Right. I was just thinking aloud to clarify the ideas myself. But the resistance to entropy, I think it's I see that I see it as a moment, as you called it before, of crystallization. In a way, crystallization, in the way we are talking, has to do, to my point of view, with some cultural value, and not only with any other crystallization of matter, but also in the sense of presenting a cultural artifact that. Sort of crystallizes history at a certain moment in time. So, in that sense, the sort of that form of resistance to entropy has to do with that form of presentation of an object that can be understood as archetypical, provisionally, and can take part of a sort of large scope of archaic artifacts in the history of sort of material production, let's say. And then at the same time, the other side of that is that these materials, instead of being captured by sort of singular reading that interprets them as a sort of expression of the times. I would prefer to think of them, and actually that's the way I relate to any archetypical material, as a primitive. So, in a way, I would think that form of crystallization is a sort of, it's a moment when one is producing a primitive to be reutilized in the future, as I do with other primitives. The second part of the question I don't remember it now. What was it?
The
rock. The different.
Well, I think it was
more that.
Yeah,
it,
yeah. You answered it. You answered it.
Yeah. Is that what the search for a new classicism is about? A kind of like a trend, some kind of.
transcendent or timeless piece of work?
Well, I find, okay, there are many levels. On the one hand, I find it so paradoxical that I find it attractive.
Yeah.
To work with flows of matter and to produce moments of such fixation and such rigidity, I find it challenging enough already. On the other hand, I think it's a sort of response to a situation in which I find myself generationally or culturally, that, which is the one that we were talking before about the indifference of complexity in architecture, no? The sort of the more of the sameness to which complexity has, to my point of view, arrived a few years ago already, not now.
With two women.
Yeah, I mean, increasing the capabilities that I mean, let's say that what new tools have enabled us is to produce more of the same, more of the same, and
that's what tooling is.
Wait,
capital T tooling.
Tooling. What do you mean? Maybe I'm not understanding your.
Not
the book. The practice. The process.
The process of making your own procedural rule-based systems for designing.
What with that? What was the question you were asking with that?
Like, that's what you're describing, tooling.
I love myself a little bit now, actually. Yeah, I mean, I think that the more the world progresses, and actually this is again part of what we were discussing last time, yesterday with the living, that there is a point when the capabilities have become so so high that it's not producing much new. It's they are producing mostly similar conditions, mostly homogeneous things, apparently differentiated internally, but internally not really differentiated from themselves, and also not differentiated from other artifacts.
Is that a limitation of the tool?
Well, can I ask clarification?
Yes.
I mean, you're talking about this generation. You're kind of characterizing them by as a generation of tools that builds their own
yes.
procedural design tools. Is that how you how do you characterize this this generation that you're talking about? What's the defining characteristics of this work?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about as well. I was talking about that. And I include myself in that. I mean, it's a very broad description of the generation. It's
Do you think we've hit a kind of saturation point?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Now?
Like, no, not now. A few years ago already.
2006.
2003.
2003.
Yeah.
The year we established our practice.
I don't know. I'm just saying.
What happened in 2003?
No. I just made up a year.
Right. But it's around there.
It's around there when I started to feel oppressed by the indifference.
By the indifference.
Yeah. By the indifference of what I was seeing around, and when I started to see that the challenge of producing difference. Was getting really enormous. Like if you really take it as a well anyway. And that's when I started to sort of go against the grain.
Do you see it as a kind of plateauing? That we've hit a kind of let's say a flattening out where things just start to look the same because they're not getting any more different?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's just about us. I think it's also about how the role of architecture and how architecture has been demanded to do things so the type of service that architecture involves is also part of that. And like this caricature of the kind of contemporary city has been made of a number of narcissistic objects that are supposedly different to the rest, but they're all the same because they're all different to the rest. That kind of caricature. So I don't think it's about the generation, or it's not about the tooling only. I think it's sort of condition of the market as well. And
the market forces architects to differentiate from themselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically what normative practices, what they are producing is strange artifacts, because that's what they are required to do as well. There is not such a, in the same way that there is not such a difference between, well, there is not such a difference between, I don't know, research practices or academic practices, avant-garde practices, and normative practices. They're part of one system. They are more stages in one system. And I feel that produces.
Do you define yourself in any of those three areas?
I wish I was a Pilatin, but I'm not.
The avant-garde or the?
No, the normative.
The normative.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I wish I was there, but I mean,
you spent the first half of the conversation positioning yourself in resistance to that mode of commodification of practice.
Yes. No, I mean it in a different way, actually. I mean it in the sense of, I don't want to get too complicated, I think, but
it's a layman's version.
The farther I am from the normative, the more my own work gets normative, because the more it gets filtered through the right filters to arrive to the public in a form that is acceptable. So in that sense, I'm saying I wish I was part of the normative system, not in the sense that I want to do the same thing, but I want to avoid the filters. I wish I could avoid the filters.
I might angle a slightly different tack, but I find the kind of critique that you're making of more of the same in a kind of dumb way. Both of your practices from project to project don't necessarily produce a consistent body of work. That's in some level, even though people might be inclined to lump you in with tooling practitioners and other things, on a certain level, that doesn't seem to be an end for either of your practices, that maybe on a certain level are conceptual practices, that you almost build each project from the ground up. Establishing different ground rules and different systematic sets of concerns or desires or whatever you'd say. So is that a reasonable observation, or do you think that?
Well,
no.
Do you position yourself?
I think it's reasonable for the practice. I think it's reasonable for the carrying their practice. I think it is. But there is, for what I know of your practice, and I think that there is a sort of commitment to singularity in your work, like a commitment to the particularity of each project. And in that sense, I can see what you say last month in that practice.
Well, not yours.
I try to do that in all levels, from the particularity of each project to the particularity of each student project, to the particularity of each brief or or sort of theoretical agenda I kind of start. I try to make them sort of crystallize in a very particular artifact. That's an intention.
Should we take a break? Yeah, more beer.
What do you want to avoid that? Is it recording?
Yes. Yeah, let's talk about it. Chris, why do you want to avoid being part of a generation?
Or the discussion of a generation?
It's not that I'm not trying to avoid being part of a generation.
I was just
trying to avoid being part of a generation. Just excuse me out trying to position myself relative.
How old are you?
36.
This was a great chance to lie to that question.
To what?
To lie. Yeah, we're all the same age here. 35.
I'm 43. So I'm quite old.
You look great for 43.
43 is that old. Anyway, but I mean, I was thinking of this. So, I mean, in a way, I also have that sort of. On the one hand, I feel challenged. I mean, I feel attracted by the generational problem, let's say, and I kind of hit against it all the time. At the same time, I intuitively, even I tried to go through it. Actually, I was thinking today that when you were going to ask me that question, I thought, well, I'm going to define myself as transgenerational. Like, I'm constantly trying to be young again. No, it's like I redefine my parameters so I set something that is coming. Let's say, right? I try to look at what is coming, and that's how
I.
I mean, I'm not a fan of David Bowie, but I really respect that, actually.
Yeah. Or Madonna.
Well, I mean, yeah. But that's sort of for definition of problems, no?
Well, I guess my question was a little bit that you three together seem to me have a common disgust or anxiety about being aligned with certain named movements, certain discourses, certain ideas and practices that are mainstream or categorical in a certain way. And I guess I would both ask, is that a fair characterization? And if so, why? Where does that come from?
Anxiety to
fear of death.
Fear of death. To the end?
No, maybe we should be honest about this issue of being part of a generation. I mean, first of all, it's an honor. It's actually an honor to be assumed that you're part of something. I mean, that it means that you're on some kind of trajectory that with other people.
Yeah.
And if you're recognized as a protagonist in this journey, then great. There's nothing wrong with it. But I do share the kind of skepticism that Ciro was talking about earlier, where there tends to be a kind of a dumbing down of the originary motives behind the work, and people do only relate to maybe the means of production, not necessarily the foundations of the practice. And that's you know, I wish there was maybe more discussion. If it's about a generation, like I wish it was discussion of things that of maybe deeper motives rather than shared expertise.
I expect we'll learn about your deeper motives when the tables are turned, right? Do you feel like you've gotten that at Zero's deeper motives?
Actually, I would, let's just talk about your deeper motives. where are you from?
From Argentina, from Buenos Aires.
From Buenos Aires. Do you think that being South American affects some of your positions on power that you discussed earlier in the interview?
Yes. I think being South American, yes, but less. And then being from Buenos Aires, yes, and a lot.
A lot.
Yeah.
How so? I'd like to know.
Okay, being South American, I think it has a sort of influence on some sort of consciousness about power.
Yeah.
That has to do with the minoritarian condition of South American cultures. And in a way, it's an inferiority. Sorry?
I've never heard that word. It's a great word, minority.
Okay, and I think it's a sort of reaction to that sort of minor condition. But that's the idea of power that has to do with forms of control, forms of repression, or forms of dominance. There is the other idea of power, which is understanding it as a potency, or as a question of capability, and I think that's more important in my work. And that's what I would say comes more from the fact, or at least has something to do with the fact that I'm from Buenos Aires. Partly because the question of partly because Buenos Aires has a culture that is deeply continental European, and in a way I feel that in my work that implies a sort of commitment to the discipline as a field, and like a serious commitment, you know, like I am kind of linked to a sort of field that I have to not only defend but expand, and I think that's in the very basis of my work, almost implicit in my work. On the other hand, because people from Buenos Aires are mostly arrogant, megalomaniac, and
should I pause this?
And I think I try to make that a sort of aesthetics. I would prefer to think that I'm not like that, but I know that if I am a person from Buenos Aires, I am like that. No matter what I want to do. So, to say the least, I want to make that a form of aesthetics. So, in that sense, I have a sort of commitment or I wouldn't say responsibility, but a sort of challenge with finding forms of ubiquity and capability of dealing with very different situations, and a form of universality in a way, which is something very much from Buenos Aires, from people from Buenos Aires, from the culture of Buenos Aires. Partly because it's a place that is full of immigrants that left Europe and look at the world from very far and with a large panorama as if it was in the horizon.
and trying to kind of organize it. So, yeah, I think
that's a great answer. Is there something let me ask this. Do you plan on practicing in or establishing yourself in Argentina, in Buenos Aires?
Well, I am as established as I can be at the moment. I mean, actually, one of the things I tried to do a few years ago when I moved from London to the States back to Buenos Aires was to establish my practice more formally. So that's what I've been doing.
Sorry, that was a clerical error. Then I thought you were based here in. Where are you based? In Buenos Aires.
My office is in Buenos Aires.
Okay.
I have. My office is in Buenos Aires. My architectural work at the moment is in Buenos Aires. I have some work in Chile. Some work I was doing in Korea, and most of my teaching happens in the States, and not so much in Europe, in Spain in particular, and in Europe in general. But my office at the moment is in Buenos Aires, and I'm established there as much as I can be. I mean, it's not completely fixed conditions, and it can change, but it has been like this for 5 years now.
Do you find practicing in Chile that, being an Argentinian, you must think that the Chileans are even more arrogant?
No, the Chileans are not that arrogant.
It's time for full disclosure.
Is there something behind that comment?
No, my family is from Chile. That's why I'm interested. I noticed you did some work in the... we're going to scratch that last comment. I noticed you did some research in the Atacama, or in the deserts.
Yeah.
Can you talk about some of that?
Did you look at this?
I did. I'm online with Jorge Godoy, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, let's say that is my Chilean becoming. I mean, it's like my becoming Chilean. So my and that's partly, I mean, it's a good model of what I do in other places as well. Like I get very mimetic with what I think is the sort of sensibility of the place, and I actualize my methods and my thinking to particularities that I find and that I sort of idealize. So in a way, something that my prejudice built up was this sort of mix of form of poetics in architecture with an interest in the role of architecture within the forces of the landscape,
yeah,
or within the forces of nature,
mm-hmm,
and these two things together, right? So that was my sort of reading of Chilean architecture in a very, very broad sense. Perhaps very much related to the Ritoque, to the School of Valparaíso,
yeah,
and so on.
Yeah.
And I'm teaching actually in Valparaíso in a different school.
In the
Santa Maria.
Santa Maria, yeah.
So in a way, I was interested in sort of redefining that project. That has many aspects of sort of systemic attitude.
Absolutely.
But perhaps they are more improvisational, more informal, less systematic. And I, in a way, I wanted to approach that from a systematic perspective. And that's what we are doing in Atacama. We are kind of engaging with basically clouds coming up to the desert and not precipitating,
yeah,
and we're developing systems to capture
rain
and construct new forms of ecology in the desert.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing. It really does.
In a way, that's sort of, I mean, beyond the fact that I'm doing that in Chile, and it's very interesting because of the culture also, the culture of that school and so on. it's also a model for me. I mean, the way I engage with other places, like I don't know, maybe it was credit later, but
yeah,
for example, when I give workshops, I try to deal with those forms of idealization of what I find in particular. So went to Lebanon, found that traffic is incredibly rich, aggressive, beautiful, and made a workshop on maneuvering and forms of infrastructure that in a way are self-organizing forms of maneuvering.
Yeah.
Going to Sicily now, and I'm kind of thinking of how to deal with the idea of luxury, with decadent luxury, and trying to idealize that. But that's only, it's going to happen, so I don't know what I'm going to do about that. So
it was very, I mean, I asked you about your experience in Chile because my own has, it was very illuminating that that certain ways of working, let's say computationally here in the U.S. and in sort of continental Europe, ways of practicing architecture that we've seen in schools, I found that in certain schools in Chile, like La Católica,
mm-hmm.
and Mitoque, that they were dealing with similar kind of emergent phenomena, but really in a way that was hands-on and directly applied in situ, like in, you know, on the beach or in the desert, or you know, and they learn in a way like kind of on the job. And I found that to be I found it to be a good lesson that maybe we need to get out of the lab more often.
Mm. Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, I think it's the potential of self-organization is everywhere. And maybe I'm not talking about the culture of Chile, but more about certain processes that are actually happening. And that they are just not self-conscious, and kind of engaging with some of the things that are happening everywhere, like markets in La Paz, for example. That was another thing we were doing, engaging with these things and just distilling intelligence from them and systematizing them is very much sort of research work. It's very much like a lab, but it's directly engaging with existing processes and kind of things happening.
How
and also at the material level, I think it's also very interesting to work with very low technologies.
Absolutely.
And to work with them because of the limitations, they have a sort of challenge that can be very quickly, very directly engaged by systemic procedures.
How do you go about absorbing the information from a kind of existing emergent system?
How do I do it?
Okay. Yeah.
Like clouds on a desert,
yeah,
or something,
or traffic in Lebanon.
How do you
get to that?
Yeah, how do you
how do you extract the intelligence?
Ah, okay. So not how do I get to that, but how do we abstract?
What do you do when you get there?
Yeah.
Because there's one. I mean, there's
good question.
There's one. There's a tendency in both in our work, both of our work, to start simply and produce complexity. It's another thing to start with complexity as the at the starting point of a project.
Mm.
Yeah, well, I mean, okay, I wanted to answer because I thought that that's what you were asking, but then I will answer your question. I wanted to answer, misunderstanding your question, I wanted to answer that I get there intuitively.
Yeah.
So,
are you going to say on a plane?
It just happens. It just happens. I have no method for that. Yeah, and it's sort of cultivated intuition. It's not just intuition like inspiration. So, of course, I go to Chile and I have a certain acknowledgement, general enough anyway, and to what I feel is the culture of the place. Then I start sort of registering sort of evidences of that, and then that ends up being impression that I just exaggerate and turn it into a sort of problematic. No? That's how it's happening in many different places. Like just even at the moment when I'm just experiencing something and I'm thinking what should I do here, and then at that moment I think actually what I should do here is what is happening to me now.
Should collect water.
And I just idealize it. Actually, your question, which was more about how to deal with those processes that are already happening and have their own complexity, I try to turn, especially when teaching, I try to one way or another reduce them to rules, basically, to sort of protocols or relations, simple ones that are extremely reductive and they don't account for the totality of the process, but that I know have the capability to produce again complexity, and they can absorb other rules on the way. So I just start by dissecting some of the rules that I see in the process. So in a way I work also for simplicity in that sense.
Yeah, sound like great studios.
Yeah, they're fun.
Do you categorize yourself as a architect in the conventional disciplinary sense?
I hope so. I don't want to think of myself as a researcher or as a sort of research as practice. I want to think of myself as a regular architect, and that research is a condition of the practice by default. And in a way, I mean, the thing is that the problem that I usually confront always tend to take me to a place of madness. Or sort of alienation in relation to the conventions of the discipline, but I mean actually, and that's part of the problem of the symmetry to some extent, or to the question of, or let's say the question of disorder. No, it's like all that comes on its own, kind of
free.
Yeah, I mean you can't avoid that.
Sure.
So. It's always the effort is always a normative effort, a kind of repressive, conventionalizing, conservative effort of turning those things that tend to complexify themselves and go out of control, turn them into sort of fixed conditions, conventional conditions or acceptable conditions. So, in a sense, I think of my work as a highly conservative work, actually. It's only that I can't avoid it getting always sort of lost.
Does the present, this is a general question that everyone has to answer, or doesn't have to answer, but is asked. Is the question of relevancy of architectural practice to the current climate?
The weather?
During the crisis.
The economy.
Yeah, I mean, this is a time now in like the early 90s when most practitioners went underground and went into academia and they were architectures. Except it's much worse. And I guess the question is, where does the relevancy of practice lie in those moments? Or where is the most productive?
To be honest, we don't know if it's much worse. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see,
yeah.
10 years from now if it was much worse or if it was something momentaneous. I don't know.
I agree with that.
There is a sort of... I don't know. There is a sort of propaganda about a crisis,
yeah,
that maybe it's too soon to say. I don't know. But I see an opportunity in the crisis. Many opportunities. First of all, I think it's to everyone we were discussing at the beginning, for example, it's let's say part of the conditions that we were talking have to do with the abundance and sort of excess of production that has been happening in the last 10 years, an excess of product of consumption as well. So a moment of slowing down is not bad. Because it may produce more quality and less sort of noise. To a certain extent, maybe not if it lasts for too long, but to some extent I think it's a good opportunity to rationalize things and to settle qualities and discourse.
But first of all, I agree that we're kind of in the storm, and it's very difficult to make any proclamations about real change or exactly how bad it is. I mean, today, yesterday, Goldman Sachs announced their $1.8 billion profit for this quarter, and we just gave them $10 billion like last year. It was so I don't know if we are.
But firms across the city are laying lots of people off. A lot of work is stopping. That's the context of the question.
Yes.
Is that there's fear. And I think there's the prospect of being in a moment where if the architect is perceived to be a kind of luxury to the process of building these days, because you don't always need an architect to build.
But let's be careful. Let's be careful about defining defining architects as kind of need based or just desire based. Services. There's this propensity in the media to use the crisis as a kind of leveling out opportunity for all sorts of discourses in architecture right now, where you have people that feel vindicated that we can now suddenly discuss about architecture only in terms of kind of bootstrap, put your bootstraps on, let's clean up the world, let's fix things, let's stop talking about these issues which are not important. And I think it's dangerous to throw away what took a very long time to build up. Some of these issues which people don't want to think are important anymore are actually very germane to the discipline.
What in particular?
I think a lot of stuff that we've been talking about today. it's not, it's, these aren't things that you, these aren't, you know, these aren't good time, you know, tools for the good times, you know, these are ways of not only creating new realities, but creating the opportunity to practice architecture in a way that might even safeguard you from some of the problematics that have come up recently. I mean, you talked about using these ways of working as a way to open up the opportunities in a practice, destabilize kind of conventional modes of practice. Right? One would imagine that, that makes you kind of more agile, or at least more aggressive, when the shit hits the fan and we're in a crisis like we are now.
Well, another observation that I would make that's interesting is that you tend to use very sophisticated tools, but also to engage very simple and often primitive modes of material production as the basis of the problem. In your case, capacity leaving or whatever it is, that often you're looking, you're interrogating a kind of person. Very old modes of actually building and looking at perhaps there are new prospects for engagement with the tools that are available.
Yeah.
Now.
Yes.
That's not a good question, though.
No, but also, I mean, in a way, even if the fear of the profession becoming redundant or luxurious in a more stringent, you would say, reality. Is that the word?
It's good. Yeah.
It's a as a profession, maybe, yes. And I wouldn't fear so much paper architecture. I think it's, and there are other ways of looking at that. And maybe it's a moment when architecture is going to build up again in the form of capital A. Problem, and these are sort of pendular situations, and for the discipline, it's a good moment to do that. After all the sort of diarrhea, on which
I'm purging
of sort of supposed innovation, it's not a bad moment to sort of rationalize that and classified and disregard 90% of that to sort of distill it. Even in that level, I don't see it as an opportunity. I don't see it as a problem. I see it as an opportunity in disciplinary terms. Maybe not so much in professional terms, but in disciplinary terms, it's a pendular moment. Actually, something that I'm more interested in is what will happen after the crisis. Like how will architecture then proceed? Because probably at the end of the crisis there is a much more stable way of producing the same thing that have been produced in the last 10 years, a much more dominant way of doing that. And the question to me is how to get there in good shape as a profession or as a field of knowledge. How to engage that at that moment.
That's a good
comment to end on.
Yeah, that's a good conclusion.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, really good. Yeah.
And then, you're recording now?
Why not?
So during the lecture I filled the house and I don't know, Sanford was there. This should be off the record actually.
I think well now we're talking about the interview. This should actually be the interview. Yeah. Well, I think you were clear. I mean you should maybe I mean, I wouldn't call you a classicist, but maybe we can call you a classicist.
Can you rewind? No, you were saying that you were, or maybe you rewind. No, about the social responsibility problem, no?
And your grace as being some criteria for evaluating work as being successful.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, I think there is no question to regret about that. Actually, I think it's a high responsibility that we have, high social responsibility to produce new forms of beauty.
And a privilege.
And a privilege and a sort of, a right that we made for ourselves. But at the same time, it's a big responsibility. And I think it's also beyond the word responsibility, you know? It's like something that sort of... I think responsibility is one of those words that seem important, but actually very low. Like justice, you know? Those words that are seem like important words, you know? And actually are kind of... they flatten things out.
Problem with beauty, the Berkeley problem is that it's tough to talk about because it's such a non-objective category.
Well, but the interesting thing about classicism was that it became an objective category.
Huh? Yeah, and in that sense, it's oppressive. Yeah. It's either oppressive because it's a codified system of beauty, or if you accept that it's totally subjective, then you can only be pursuing beauty on your own terms, and it seems solipsistic. And so it is antithetical to a kind of ecological or social responsible view of how you should conduct a practice. I think if it suffers from that, that's kind of how it's become to be something that's almost that's used sometimes as a pejorative in architecture and art.
How would you evaluate the success of your collaboration with Matthew and Chief?
Let's just save this for our interview.
Sorry. But I am interested because, for example, in listening to the other review
and architects and Alejandro Aravena, for example, there was a kind of a belt tightening sensibility there in response to the contemporary moment and a sense that we needed to reorient practice to some extent. But there was a kind of a superficiality toward in the kind of fastness of production in the last several years in the booming economy, and that perhaps something has been lost in a kind of fundamental ethical way in the way that we work and the work that we produce, and that there was a kind of opportunity in this moment to sort of reorient it back towards other values that have been perhaps left behind.
No, I'm just feeling what you're saying. I think there are, and I don't know if this is being recorded, but I think there are conservative forms of conservatism and progressive forms. And when you kind of, I don't know. Yeah, it's true. Actually, that's one of the dangers, actually. I mean, I don't like to talk about dangers, but to use the crisis as an opportunity to produce a sort of reorientation of knowledge to important issues, that's a bad thing, actually, I think. It's like it's an opportunity to make the I mean, when you were saying that as well, like to make things that have been happening as a way of enriching the practice and so on, to shift from that and to use the opportunity to sort of become, or to, yeah, I don't know if I should use the word mediocre, but like to make things sort of common sense, no?
I mean, there are opportunities, but it's not. We shouldn't undergo a self-lobotomization. Rather, there's an opportunity for a greater intensity. I mean, we find in our own practice that now we need to be more aggressive about finding the opportunities to apply this thinking.
I mean, it is undeniable that there's recently been some excess to the point that it leads to mediocrity. It is undeniable that there is a kind of crisis at the moment. But I think, as I was saying, it doesn't mean that you need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. As we reevaluate, it calls for a wholesale reevaluation.
Yeah. Well, I guess I almost wonder if there's something in the nature of your conviction and your mode of practice, which means that you wouldn't necessarily change the way that you operated so much, independent of what's going on outside.
Mm. You're wondering if we're going to continue working the same way?
Well, it seems possible that you might.
Yeah. What's the problem?
I'm really asking.
Actually. I mean, it shows a kind of conviction about your work and the way that you work, the things that drive it, the underlying motives don't change. I mean, that you're not, you haven't been building condos for the last 5 years, you've always been in a kind of position of self-sufficiency in a certain way.
Yeah, I mean, to be really frank, like, you know, everybody's talking about, you know, the party's over, and we're just kind of like, what party?
We're trying.
Like,
yeah. I've been taking a lot of mail.
Who has these?
Yeah. It's just a different form of difficulty now.
Yeah.
But we're used, you know, we're...
It's a more distributed difficulty.
Yeah. It's a different, yeah.
Many are the same.
Sorry. Okay. That's like 2 hours.